Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our special edition of our live stream this evening. I just get my camera adjusted here, and we will dive right into a very long list of topics that we need to cover this evening. What is different tonight is not so much the topics we're covering. Many of these are familiar to you as subscribers, but this program will also be released tomorrow on our YouTube channel. And that is part of our, that is part of our Pulse program or Pulse channel on YouTube, which of course is a public forum. Normally these live streams, for those that are in the public on YouTube watching this tomorrow or whenever, these are private live streams. If you'd like to participate in the deeper dives, the more specific information that we cover that I'm typically not allowed to cover in the words, in the verbiage, in the context that is restricted by the community guidelines on YouTube, that information that I cannot share on YouTube, we share here on these live streams. There's a lot more I can say about that, but if you'd like to join us on these live streams on a regular basis, please subscribe. Go to anthonypatch.com and hit the subscribe tab. So without further ado, I want to give you an idea of where we're headed this evening. We will be speaking about the president and the presidential race a little bit. We will be speaking about Netanyahu a great deal tonight. We will be speaking about the Middle East at large, all of the countries in the Middle East that are right now ramping up in their events, in their saber rattling, and in their military strikes. So we're going to spend a great deal of time on the Middle East. We will touch on the Ukraine, of course, and then towards the end, China, and how China fits into all of this, which includes NATO. And let me make a quick note on my note to add NATO to that connection with China. All right. So a lot of times in these live streams, I have reference material, I have scientific papers, I have patents, we have news articles that we have vetted, and tonight this really is hitting the treetops, if you will, hitting the bullet points on a broad spectrum of topical areas that I just outlined for you. So I don't really have, as we typically do, a single punchline right up front or a headline that I can deliver to you, which is my typical method of beginning these live streams. Again, I'm speaking to the public. Subscribers here already are familiar with our format. Let's begin with the president. The president's health is greatly in question, his mental health specifically, but the claim is that he has been diagnosed with COVID and was diagnosed some 5 or 6 days ago with COVID. That's not where I want to go with this. There are a lot of rumors, disinformation campaigns that are going on right now regarding the presidential campaign. President Biden is expected to address the nation tomorrow. Likewise, he is expected to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel, who is scheduled. Netanyahu is scheduled to speak before Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, the Congress of the United States. There are a number of Democrats that are stating that they are going to boycott. I mentioned on the Sunday live stream that the Sergeant at Arms will be bringing forth multiple Sergeants of Arms. And Speaker McCarthy has stated that he will, if necessary, arrest anyone that attempts, even Democrats, anyone that attempts to disrupt the presentation on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu, that they will be arrested. So that is very unusual. I've not heard or seen of that before. I'm just checking my notes here real quickly. Give me just a second here. I need to verify before we proceed. But nonetheless, I want to do a little bit of a dive into what I think Netanyahu already has been doing in Washington since he arrived on Monday. Mike Johnson, that's who I'm trying to remember the name accurately. Mike Johnson is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and he is the one who is indicating that there may be arrests of anyone that attempts to disrupt Netanyahu's presentation. As you'll recall, Israel financially supports the campaign for election and re-election of most of the senators and representatives in the United States. Thus, they have an allegiance to Israel and support Israel. Apparently, the last time Netanyahu addressed Congress, he received 54 standing ovations. The Republicans have said for many months now that they intend to exceed 54 standing ovations. The Democrats, for their part, not only are boycotting some of them, but some are choosing to disrupt those standing ovations. That's not the big deal. The big deal is the president, or those that are operating in his place, to put it politically, have been discussing with Netanyahu Monday, Tuesday, and that's today, Tuesday the 23rd, tomorrow is the 24th, Wednesday, discussing U.S. support for Israel, specifically support for Israel attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon. Netanyahu wants to make sure that Congress will approve full 100% support, militarily, financially, politically, support of Israel striking Hezbollah. That's the core of what I want to present tonight. If we need a punchline, if we need a headline, it is Hezbollah and Israel, and then we will expand upon that. But this has everything to do with the president's health, his mental state, whether or not he will remain not in the campaign, which he's already withdrawn from, but will he remain as president between now and January of next year? Will Kamala Harris, the vice president, will she succeed in the presidency? Will she ascend to the presidency? And if so, who will be the vice president? So I wanted to read this quick note, and this is why I was double checking, especially because we have an international audience here. I just want to cite from our Constitution, specifically the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, the present line of succession. President Biden is still president, so let's go down the line of succession. Next, of course, is the Vice President, Kamala Harris. Speaker of the House of Representatives is Mike Johnson. He's next. Mike Johnson, should Kamala Harris, I shouldn't say replace, but should she ascend to the presidency on a constitutional basis, then constitutionally speaking, Mike Johnson becomes the vice president. Now, there's a distinction that needs to be drawn between succession and selection of the vice president. Succession would be in a situation where the president is forced out of the presidency. The 25th Amendment of the Constitution indicates that the president would be replaced for a based on a number of criteria. If it is determined that he is mentally incapacitated, then he is removed from his position as president, and automatically, Kamala Harris becomes vice president. Those of you here in the United States, you're already familiar with what I'm describing. In that replacement of the president, because he's been removed from office, then the vice president moves up the line, as does the Speaker of the House automatically move to the position of vice president. Okay? Now, if we are considering, rather than succession, we are talking about a vote, an election, a replacement of Biden by election, it is not an automatic that Kamala Harris would be president. She would need to be elected. Again, this is self-evident to citizens of the United States. In the case of Kamala Harris being elected as president, or anyone else, there's a discussion now in the Democratic Party of an open selection of candidate for president, meaning it does not necessarily need to be Kamala Harris. It can be an open session, and during the Democratic convention, that is the time when the candidate is selected to run for president. Should that candidate, whether it's Kamala or anyone else, be elected as president, in other words, defeat candidate Trump, then the president selects his or her vice president. Now, in ordinary campaign circumstances, this would be a candidate for president who would then name a running mate, already name a vice president. Now, that may occur before the election on November 5th of this year, that whoever is selected as the candidate for president already will have selected and announced a running mate for vice president. It is up to the president to select a vice president. Okay? That's the basic idea. That's the basic construct of the chain of events. What we're looking at here that is such an unknown is, will President Biden resign from the presidency of his own accord? And again, that needs to be defined. Does he have the mental capacity to do that? Will he behind the scenes be influenced? Again, I'm being politically sensitive. Will he be influenced and encouraged to then announce his resignation as president? At which point Kamala Harris would move up in the line of succession? Or will he be forced out of the presidency? I mean, from a constitutional process, forced out of the presidency before the election. That's the direction I think things are going, that the president will be forced out of office and Kamala Harris will ascend and the speaker will become vice president. That's going into the November 5th election, okay? I think it's self-evident to most everyone that the president really is not in a position to remain as president. During the remaining 3.5 months of his presidency, running until January of 2025. Let me just look something up here real quick. The 25th Amendment of the United States Constitution establishes the line of succession for the presidency in Section 1, Clause 6 of Article 2. Vice President. The Vice President becomes President if the President dies, resigns, or is removed from office. Okay. If both the President and Vice President are unable to serve, the Speaker of the House becomes President. So the Speaker would then succeed in the line of succession to the presidency. Section 2 requires the president to nominate a vice president to fill a vacancy, which must be confirmed by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. Sections 3 and 4 of the 25th Amendment allow the vice president to become acting president if the president is temporarily disabled, such as due to surgery or mental illness. So there's another wrinkle in there, sort of a third aspect to this, the mental illness component. Kamala Harris would be the acting president. Now that's kind of splitting hairs, but yes, she would succeed the president. She would ascend to the presidency. She would be the acting president until the election takes place. And she would continue until the election is completed and the inauguration of the candidate, which is between November and January. She'd be acting president until the inauguration in January. So Kamala Harris could conceivably be the president, perhaps in the next few days, could be president until January. There are a lot of maneuvers that are taking place behind the scenes in the Democratic Party. There's a lot of what ifs that could take place. We'll stay on top of it as much as we can and present that to you as events unfold. But I want to step away from the presidential election and understanding, as we discuss Netanyahu, that one of the great problems with Netanyahu, not necessarily appearing before Congress, but the private meetings that have been going on prior to his address, is that the president really is mentally incapacitated and is not really in a position, in my estimation, and that's all it is, not in a position to engage in these private meetings with Netanyahu. Now, whether he's mentally capable or not is really not the issue. The issue are the private meetings. And this is where I want to take us as we dive into the Middle East. I've explained in previous live streams and also in Pulse on YouTube to a certain extent, but more freely here on these live streams, that Netanyahu recognizes that the state of Israel is facing insurmountable existential threats by a number of enemies. The IDF is severely depleted of men and materiel because of Gaza, because of what they've been doing in Gaza relative to Hamas. And Hezbollah is a much more formidable opponent to Israel. It really sounds counterintuitive, but it's really strange. If you think about it from a military planning standpoint, why would you engage a enemy that is many times stronger in terms of materiel and men, training, preparation, and support by way of Iran and Russia, which we'll get to later on, why would you engage after engaging with another opponent that has severely depleted your military, your IDF, and then go after a much stronger opponent? It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. But there's no coming back from this. Israel cannot back away from what it's been doing with regard to Hamas. Likewise, it cannot back away from the threats from Hezbollah. And I'm not taking a political position here. I'm just reporting. They cannot back away from now the events regarding the Houthis out of Yemen, and we'll discuss those in detail. And cannot ignore the long-standing threat on the part of Iran to wipe Israel off the map. We also understand there are other enemies, but let's focus on these for the moment. As I said, Netanyahu is in Washington shoring up support for a preemptive strike by Israel against Hezbollah. Because Hezbollah is so much stronger and the IDF is so depleted, the only way that this can be even attempted by the IDF is with full support from the U.S. military, economic support, and of course political support. This is what Netanyahu is there in the background, in the private meetings, there to shore up and to cement, to confirm. It will be interesting to watch his address tomorrow. I will be watching it live. Following his address, I will put together another Pulse presentation for YouTube. That will be tomorrow following his address. But I think this is telegraphing a direct, open message, a warning to Hezbollah and Hezbollah's supporters that the United States is going to, it won't come out in this, this will just be an address, but if there are these standing ovations for what he states, for what he presents, that telegraphs a message to Israel's enemies and the enemies of the United States that a strike by the U.S. and Israel is imminent. That's why I say tonight's live stream is entitled Pulse, Rapidly Unfolding Events. We have the presidential candidacy election events unfolding very quickly. In the background, the attempted assassination of the candidate Donald Trump. All of those events that are unfolding rapidly and concurrently. Now we have Netanyahu in Washington. We have the threats coming from Hezbollah that have been communicated in addition to their attacks, and the warnings, the threats issued by the Houthis out of Yemen in addition to their attacks. Again, I'll detail some of that. While there's the ongoing conflict in Gaza with Hamas. Hamas is issuing its new emboldened threats, stronger threats against the IDF in Gaza. This is building, as I said in our last live stream, these events are peaking. The reactions are peaking. We fold into this what's going on in Ukraine. Briefly, Ukraine, Zelensky himself, is about to agree to peace talks. He is not necessarily about to declare a ceasefire, but his military is so depleted, they're losing casualties of, on average, 2,000 military personnel per day, 2,000 a day killed and injured. And this is just increasing. Russia, for its part, has let it be known in the last few days, they have over 300,000 reserve troops, well-trained, well-equipped, being held well behind enemy lines, the front lines. And should NATO decide to bring boots on the ground, escalate in Ukraine, they will be facing these reserves, over 300,000 men, well-trained, well-equipped. It is looking more and more like a ceasefire will be sought by Zelensky. He understands that most of his support, if not all of it, is because of Biden. Now, Biden is not personally responsible for that support. Those in his administration are the ones that have been pushing the agenda in Ukraine, pushing the NATO agenda. But nonetheless, Zelensky is as unsure as probably the rest of the world. What will happen if President Biden resigns, which is what I think the course will be? He will resign from the presidency rather than being forced out publicly. I mean, certainly behind the scenes, he's being ushered out. He's no longer of any use to the Democratic Party. But he will make a public statement, public address, or he'll issue one of what I consider now one of these infamous letters. There's a lot of question as to his letter of resignation from running the candidacy, removing himself as a candidate for president. The letter that is now public was not written on White House stationery, and there's a lot of disagreement as to whether the signature is authentic or not. Perhaps that's the route he will take again. Probably someone composing the letter for him and signing it for him. Nonetheless, it'll be a public resignation. I don't think it will be a public forcing of the president to resign, but he will resign probably in the next few days. Zelensky is worried about the change in leadership, whether that's going to decrease the amount of support by the U.S. and NATO for Ukraine. Overall, it appears, and we covered the NATO symposium or gathering last week, it does appear that NATO wants to continue to pursue and even escalate the conflict against Russia. Russia is ready for it. But I think Zelensky is quickly realizing that he cannot count on 100%, cannot count on NATO and the U.S. with all of the turmoil that's occurring with the presidency in the United States. And I think the attempted assassination on Donald Trump probably scared Zelensky enough to think, okay, maybe I need to seek a peaceful solution and disappear into the night. I don't know. So let's get back to Israel. You know that the Houthis have been exchanging attacks with Israel. The Houthis sent a drone to Tel Aviv, detonated in a civilian high-rise building a block from the U.S. Embassy, which I believe was the actual intended target. In response, Israel bombed the oil depot in Yemen, in the port of, let me get the name here if I can read this. I can never pronounce it properly. Hodeidah, H-O-D-E-I-D-A, Hodeidah, the port city of Hodeidah, basically eliminated the entire oil depot there. And this was a demonstration to Iran on the part of Israel that they could launch and fly and deliver bombs by fighter bombers from Israel to Yemen, some 1,800 kilometers. And there were at least three mid-air refueling events per aircraft, per fighter bomber that took place. In a demonstration to Iran, which is a shorter distance from Israel, that Israel could reach out with its IDF Air Force and bomb Iran itself, that they have the in-flight refueling capacity capability. And that was due to the United States over the preceding years having supplied Israel with these tanker jets, tanker aircraft, to be able to extend the range of these fighter bombers. So that was a message, not just to the Houthis as retribution, but a message to Iran itself. Okay. Now, if you pick that capability up by the IDF Air Force and apply it to Hezbollah in a coming conflict, the question arises, will this be boots on the ground? Will this be strictly an air campaign? It cannot be a boots on the ground only, nor can it be just an air campaign. Air campaigns require boots on the ground. You can't bomb everything, and you cannot destroy everything, and there are underground facilities. In order to really achieve a victory, you have to put people in harm's way on the ground. The IDF, as I said earlier, is not in a position to do that, to put boots on the ground. Nor are they in a position to deliver an air campaign that will, as the IDF leadership has said, when we strike, not if, but when we strike Lebanon, we will return Lebanon to the Stone Age. Now, because this broadcast is going out on YouTube, I need to abide by the community standards, the community guidelines, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. If you cannot win with an air campaign, and you cannot win with boots on the ground, in terms of a weapons system, you fill in the blank. Recognizing, as I said earlier, Israel faces an existential threat. The actual continued existence of the state of Israel is in question. The enemies of Israel view this time as the time and the opportunity to eliminate the state of Israel. I'm not advocating, I'm reporting. Therefore, as we understand, Israel is eventually compassed, surrounded by its enemies. That's the situation Israel finds itself today. Not of some future event, but today. There's an inner circle and an outer circle of enemies. If you can't win by air and you can't win by ground and you can't combine the two and win, you only have one weapon system that you can deliver apart from aircraft and apart from equipment on the ground. There's only one weapon system that can deliver as a weapon system, something that will immediately defeat a much larger and stronger enemy. You fill in the blanks. That's the situation we are facing. And with Netanyahu going to Washington, he wants to ensure that the U.S., let's put it this way, that the U.S. has the stomach for using that weapons system. I'm not naming it here. You understand what it is. The U.S. has already, much like the IDF has done with regard to Hamas, the U.S. has been doing the same thing in Ukraine with regard to Russia. We find our weapons systems severely depleted. We don't have, other than special forces, we don't have boots on the ground in Ukraine yet. But the present administration wants to place boots on the ground and more than just 16 F-15s in Ukraine. So we have a situation where the U.S. is facing very much the same sort of dilemma that the IDF is facing. If the U.S. is still pushing to defeat Russia, this has been the whole agenda of Ukraine. Ukraine is a proxy of the U.S. and, by extension, NATO. The U.S. and NATO want to occupy Ukraine. Ukraine has, in terms of an asset, in terms of its natural resources, has the best soil, the best fertilizers on the planet. This is what the West wants control of, wants to utilize the farmland. This was the same thing with the Wehrmacht under Hitler in World War II. They wanted Ukraine. They were fighting the Soviet Union at the time. They wanted Ukraine because it would feed Germany. This is very much the same type of mentality today. It is a natural resource. Beyond Ukraine, the same holds true for Russia with regard to its natural resources. The West wants control of the gas and the oil and uranium deposits and other natural resources by breaking up the Russian Federation into smaller, manageable parts, individual states. That's the goal. The United States, depleted of weapons and really not finding a great deal of support for putting boots on the ground, faces the decision to use the same type of weapon system that I anticipate the IDF to employ against Hezbollah. Thus, I do not think in these backroom meetings between Netanyahu and the U.S. present administration that there's much pushback on the part of the United States with Israel and the U.S. employing these weapon systems against their respective targets. This is a very dangerous situation for the world. I don't think I need to elaborate on that. The Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. Therefore, that means that NATO and the United States cannot defeat Russia. The United States, with its missile systems in Ukraine and its operators, U.S. operators, military operators of those missile systems, have been probing the early warning radar systems of Russia. And Russia understands that this is an attempt at some point in the future, an attempt by the West to blind Russia to incoming missiles. And again, I won't identify the type of warhead, but you can fill in the blank. That's the situation in Ukraine. It's not the situation with Israel. Israel will be using smaller warheads, but nonetheless the same type. This is not lost on Hezbollah, nor Syria, nor Turkey. It's not lost on Iraq, and it's certainly not lost on Iran. And when I mention Iran, we need to understand that Iran has a mutual defense agreement with Russia. So when we're talking about Iran being attacked by the IDF, we are talking about Russia coming to the defense of Iran. Now, Anthony Blinken has been saying over the course of the last week that, I think he said this about 4 or 5 days ago, that Iran is within 1 to 2 weeks, so now we're looking at maybe a week and a half, away from achieving that certain type of warhead. Up to this point, what the warning has been that has been put out regarding Iran achieving this type of warhead, this type of weapon system, it has been said, oh, in 5 years, or in 6 months, or in a year. It's never been 1 to 2 weeks. Again, these are the rapidly unfolding events. We need to fold all of these together. We need to bring all these together because they're all coalescing at the same moment, in the same shared timeline. Now, whether or not Iran will achieve this weapon system, it's really almost irrelevant because they are already an ally not only of Russia, who can supply this weapon system, but Pakistan. In the last few days, Pakistan openly in the press stated that they are in support of Iran. And should they come under attack by the IDF, Pakistan is ready to come to the defense. And openly stated, I can't say it here, but openly stated, that they will employ this weapon system against Israel. Again, this is the outer ring of Israel being compassed by its enemies. The inner ring is the Houthis to the south, Hamas in Gaza, and to the north, Hezbollah. And by extension, we can also say Iraq, and we can say Egypt, and even Saudi Arabia. But Pakistan coming in puts a whole nother wrinkle in the discussion. So Blinken warning about that, really, I turn that 180 degrees around and say, what Blinken is actually saying is that the US and Israel, within 1 to 2 weeks, is going to strike Iran, using as an excuse the intelligence reports, the analyst reports, and I say these are alleged reports, that within 1 to 2 weeks, Iran will achieve this weapon system. It gives us a sense of a time frame with respect to targeting of Iran, which means simultaneous targeting of Hezbollah, simultaneous targeting of Syria. Assad's army at this point has been told by Russia, told by Putin, to not engage with Israel unless Israel engages Hezbollah. Again, Syria is heavily supported by Russia. In fact, there's some 1,000 to 2,000 Russian troops in Syria. We have special forces operations in forward operating bases throughout Syria. Iran, for its part, with Hezbollah personnel are in Syria, specifically Damascus. Damascus is the actual command and control center for Hezbollah. It is a shared command and control center deep underground in hardened bunkers that also commands and controls the Assad forces as well as the Russian forces. So Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria involving Hezbollah as well, and the Syrian military and Russian forces in Syria. Then Iraq next door has made it clear they will come to the defense of Iran, and in fact announced, I believe it was yesterday, Iraq has said by September of 2025, all U.S. military forces will be gone from Iraq. There may be a lingering, quote, advisory group or interfacing group with the Iraq military on the part of the U.S. military. But from this point forward, there is a drawdown of military forces that is slated to conclude in September of 2025. So Iraq is aligning itself with Hezbollah, with Syria, with Iran, and with Russia. Again, the compassing of Israel, the existential threat to Israel that's building and mounting. Okay? To the north, we have Turkey, which is a member of NATO, second only in strength to the U.S. A NATO member that has said if the IDF strikes Hezbollah, Turkey will come to the aid of Hezbollah. I think by default, they are then no longer considered a member of NATO. But Turkey compassing Israel. Now let's step over to the island of Cyprus, which is directly off the coast of Lebanon and Syria and Israel, and just south of Turkey. The northern portion of the island of Cyprus has been for, I think, I want to say almost 30 years, has been occupied by Turkey. It's been controlled by Turkey, Turkish military forces in the northern portion of Cyprus. There is a horizontal dividing line, a demilitarized zone that is patrolled by, and I say that very loosely, patrolled by the UN. To the south are the Greek Cypriots. Now, yesterday, Greece announced that they intend to build and expand a naval port in the southern portion of Cyprus. Turkey's response was, then we will build in the northern portion a naval base. The IDF has been moving out of harm's way fighter bomber aircraft and placed them on Cyprus. Of course, Hezbollah has said, we will bomb Cyprus, meaning the southern portion, if Israel continues to do this. If Greece continues to give shelter to the IDF Air Force, then Hezbollah will strike Cyprus. Okay, so we've got a lot of players on the chessboard here. We've got a lot going on. Let me look at my notes here real quickly. Let's go back to the Houthis for a moment. In response to the oil depot bombing, the southern resort port in Israel of Eilat was attacked. It was targeted with a missile by the Houthis. Israel claims that out of the atmosphere, in a suborbital altitude, that they intercepted this incoming missile to defend Eilat. Okay, that's fine. I was just reading a report today that that port city of Eilat is bankrupt, and there are over 30,000 businesses that have gone bankrupt. Because remember, the Houthis have been, and continuing even to today, they have been bombing and commandeering cargo ships on the Red Sea, and this has directly impacted the port city of Eilat. It's bankrupted. This also illustrates and contributes to the bankruptcy of the Israeli economy. You know that the IDF is made up of civilian reserves, and when they are fighting Hamas, they are not engaged in the economy. Thousands upon thousands of Israelis have already fled Israel. That impacts the economy. Certainly the cost of the war is hurting the economy, and the disruption that takes place because of the war. So again, this paints a picture of Netanyahu being painted into a corner, backed into a corner. I'm not saying that to defend him nor his prospective actions. I'm just reporting the situation as I view it, as I estimate it, that he's in a no-win situation. Now, much of this is his own aggression, his own, I consider, lunacy on his part, but it reflects the aggressiveness of the expansion agenda by the Zionists, politically speaking, the Zionists of Israel, the Zionist government, the expansion of Israel. You've heard of the settlements and settlers, Israeli settlers moving into Palestinian areas, traditionally Palestinian areas, and Lebanese areas, even in Lebanon itself over the border. So Hezbollah considers itself to be a defensive force because of the Zionist agenda to continue to expand the state of Israel, encompassing the ancient borders of the Promised Land, the Levant Zionist agenda. I won't expand on that. I just wanted to briefly cite that. So we have a situation here where the Houthis understand that Yemen is part of that Zionist agenda, and they have been fighting against, as many of the Islamic faith have been fighting against Israel, and view Israel as a cancer in the Middle East, a cancer to be for once and for all removed. Again, this paints a picture of the situation that Netanyahu finds himself in and why he is seeking full support from the U.S. military and the economic and political support that he would enjoy. So the Houthis have declared today that they are going to target Israeli gas fields, gas and oil fields. They're speaking and targeting, citing specifically the Tamar gas fields and the Leviathan gas fields, as well as the ships that I mentioned earlier in the Red Sea. So the Houthis have been targeting and bombing with missiles cargo ships, and you know that. And these are supposed to, in their estimation, in their targeting, in their justification, these are ships with cargo that are supporting Israel. And they have said that not until the conflict with Hamas in Gaza comes to an end, Until that happens, they will continue to target cargo ships, civilian merchant ships in the Red Sea. The U.S., for its part, in terms of trying to deal with this, they do have a carrier task force in the Mediterranean, not in the Red Sea, and have provided some limited defense along with the French and the Indian and even the Turkish Navy. And interestingly, there have been a few small Chinese ships in the Red Sea to protect the merchant, the civilian ship traffic there. It's quite a mess, quite a mess. So again, Netanyahu is in Washington because he is planning a preemptive strike against Hezbollah. In the background, we have Blinken saying Iran may achieve this weapon within 1 to 2 weeks. So that is pushing the timeline. It's publishing the timeline, I think, for this preemptive strike on the part of Israel. Now, I do want to mention something that's a little bit off topic here, but I think many people here, many of the subscribers, will already understand what I'm about to say. But I just want to make a subnote here that the evangelical churches, Christian churches here in the United States, of course, have been openly supporting Israel and almost with blinders on, irrespective of the devastation, the humanitarian crisis that's occurring with regards to Gaza and the Palestinian people in Gaza. Almost blindly, the evangelical churches have been supporting Netanyahu's agenda and the actions of the IDF. And they are pressuring Congress to support Netanyahu. Okay? Let me give you just a little bit of background on Hezbollah and the United States, the U.S. involvement in Lebanon. Back in 2006, the U.S. engaged Hezbollah, and Israel did as well. We actually had a bombing campaign against Hezbollah, and Israel was involved in that, and as it's portrayed, Hezbollah came out on top. It was a negotiated settlement through the UN, and the UN established a demilitarized line around southern Lebanon. This is known as the Blue Line, much like the demilitarized zone that I indicated runs horizontally, dividing north and south of the island of Cyprus. There is a border, a security border around southern Lebanon. And by the UN agreement that Hezbollah signed back in 2007, they were to cease aggressions against Israel. They were not to launch missiles and rockets and drones at Israel. And they were not to attempt to move south across the border with Israel and try to regain territory. That was the agreement. That was the ceasefire agreement. Of course, this has been violated by both sides ever since 2007. Back in 1982, the U.S. Marines were sent into Lebanon. The battleship New Jersey, with its 16-inch guns, was shelling the hills of Lebanon and effectively destroyed the Lebanese economy back in 1982, and Lebanon has never really recovered economically since then. That opened the door to Hezbollah to come in and begin to establish itself politically and then militarily because of the vacuum that was created by this decimated economy on the part of the U.S. and Israel in 1982. In 1982, we also suffered the deaths of 242 U.S. Marines that were housed in a hotel, and they were murdered. Now, speaking of murder, this is very controversial. This is not an anti-Semitic position on my part. I'm just reporting. I have been reticent and reluctant to cite this because it is so inflammatory. But nonetheless, this has been repeated in many media outlets since it first was reported in Haaretz, which is an Israeli publication. It's been vetted by other news organizations. This is known as Operation Hannibal. Apparently, and again, I'm just reporting what is out in the mainstream media. On October 7th, when Hamas entered Israel, there's some question as to the surveillance systems, the cameras, the guards that were posted, etc., in certain areas on the border on the part of the IDF, but nonetheless, Hamas entered into Israel on October 7th of last year, and we know what events occurred there, what's been reported. What is only coming to light in the last, say, 2 weeks is this Operation Hannibal on the part of the IDF. I mean, this is clearly a war crime, what I'm going to describe. Apparently, the IDF were ordered to kill Israeli civilians for the purpose of preventing those civilians from being taken prisoner and thus held hostage by Hamas. From a political and military strategy standpoint, this was to deny Hamas leverage against the IDF and against the political arm of the Israeli government. The Israeli government did not want hostages that would unduly influence and restrict the intended actions on the part of Netanyahu to enter Gaza and to eliminate all Palestinians. He has stated that. Again, this is Operation Hannibal. It is estimated that at least half of the people that died on October 7th died at the hands of the IDF. The release of that information has only inflamed certain members of the House of Representatives and the Senate with respect to Netanyahu addressing the combined House of Congress. Just checking my notes to make sure I've covered what I wanted to present to you. Again, I just want to repeat that Turkey, for its part, will defend Hezbollah. This is going to get out of hand very quickly. Okay? And on that note, I want to reinforce Russia's part in all of this. There's a theory that goes like this. Should Zelensky seek a ceasefire, if he should begin to withdraw troops, if he should begin to de-escalate, perhaps using the excuse that there's a lack of leadership on the part of the U.S. because of the presidential issues that are going on. Nonetheless, if he begins to lessen the intensity of the conflict on his part, and that Russia should interpret this as an opportunity to divert some of its munitions, some of its weapon systems, over to supporting Hezbollah and supporting Iran, defending Iran directly. I bring this up because it needs to be appreciated as to the unfolding of these rapidly unfolding events, how quickly the things are accelerating. I would offer to you to pay attention to any indications. We can't trust the mainstream narrative necessarily, but let's say from the alternative media news sources, if we begin, and the international news sources, if we begin to see and hear of indications that the intensity is lessening in Ukraine, that would be an indication that Russia will be better equipped, better prepared. I mean, they certainly have the depth right now, but as an indicator of timing, that Russia would be in a better position to divert resources away from Ukraine and direct those resources in defense of Iran and Lebanon, and certainly Syria as well. Now, even if things do not de-escalate in Ukraine, Russia still has the depth in terms of personnel, in terms of military equipment. Their economy has been, for at least a year now, on a wartime footing in terms of industry and manufacturing in support of the military objectives with regard to Ukraine. They certainly have the capacity to divert surplus munitions to Iran and Hezbollah and Syria. But if we see indications that Russia is being more vocal, more open in the media about its support for Iran, that gives us a sense of the tempo of how Netanyahu feels backed into a corner, pressured to strike, and to strike not just Hezbollah, but Damascus, the command and control center, and to strike targets in Iraq and targets in Iran. And these targets will be struck simultaneous to striking Gaza with heavier weapons. Again, I'm not identifying. And certainly Yemen. The Houthis don't stand a chance. I'm not talking conventional munitions. I'm not defending the Houthis, I'm just saying militarily they're outgunned by Israel. With a depleted IDF, I'm reinforcing the point, with a depleted IDF, an economy that is facing near bankruptcy, near default status, Israel does not have the luxury of time. Citizens fleeing the country, which depletes their reserve military capacity. We've seen that the Orthodox Jews are being forced with a draft. They're being conscripted for the first time into the IDFs. You've seen the demonstrations in the streets by the Orthodox Jews. Netanyahu is desperate. He does not have a lot of time. Now, let's go back to the U.S. domestically, the presidential situation. The chaos that's going on right now in the present Democratic Party-led administration. And understanding also that most of the politicians in the present administration have been financially supported and influenced by Israel. Netanyahu needs to act before November 5th. Needs to act before the elections. It really doesn't matter who the candidates are. It doesn't really matter what the outcome of the election is. simply because the preemptive strike using these certain weapons by Netanyahu needs to occur before the election. Too many things, too many variables will result from an election in the U.S. But, and we could get into a discussion of candidate Donald Trump with respect to Israel. He's financially supported into the millions by Israel. But nonetheless, I don't want to get into, well, what would Trump do if he were president? Well, he wouldn't be able to do anything until he's inaugurated in January of next year. The world is not going to allow that much time to transpire into January before decisions are made about Ukraine, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and Iran. The world doesn't have the luxury of time. And I'll get into China just sort of parenthetically towards the end here, because there's a lot going on with respect to China and specifically NATO. So it is my expectation, due to these rapidly unfolding events and the open declaration now by the Houthis, that they are at war with Israel, and there are no red lines that need to be crossed. There's no wait and see on the part of the Houthis waiting for Israel to cross some line or multiple lines before the Houthis strike with an all-out attack. They've already stated yesterday they have declared all-out war against Israel. Again, this picture of Netanyahu being painted, pushed, cornered into acting. I'm not trying to make him out as the victim, although Israel tries to paint itself all the time as the victim. They did that with October 7th, try to paint themselves as the victim and therefore justify all the follow-on actions in Gaza against the Palestinians. The humanitarian crisis, and that's to put it mildly, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza truly is on the war crime, on the genocide level. That's a legal discussion I'm not going to get into here tonight. I will say this, there are those that are calling for the arrest of Netanyahu in Washington, D.C. I doubt that it will happen. It's too much security for that. And on the note of security, you know that the head of the Secret Service has resigned. It was just a disaster. Her grilling in front of Congress yesterday was just, it was despicable how she performed, or her lack of performance. Anyway, security is very tight nonetheless for Netanyahu. I don't think he'll be arrested. Let's go back to Ukraine for just a moment. I have all of these countries, so I'm kind of jumping back and forth around them, but these are all coalescing together. All of these countries and their agendas and the events are all coming together. Ukraine, this just was reported yesterday, is seeking to renegotiate the national debt, the sovereign debt of Ukraine. Ukraine as a government, as a sovereign nation, is facing default on the part of its existing debt obligations. They are now seeking renegotiation, new terms, and in other words, refinancing their debt, their sovereign debt. So much like Israel and its crumbling economy, certainly the war has impacted Ukraine's economy, and it could be that because of this looming default on the part of Ukraine, that this may provide additional motivation for Zelensky to seek a ceasefire. It may be the financiers that put the pressure on Zelensky to say, look, you guys are near bankruptcy. We don't see any way that you can financially recover, that you can rebuild. You don't have the ability to borrow enough money to rebuild your country now. So the best thing you can do is to cut your losses now. And if you do that, then we will enter into discussions about refinancing your existing debt. I think that's what's taking place in the background. So we may in fact see a ceasefire in Ukraine, despite what NATO and the US want. I don't think it's wishful thinking on my part. It would be great on a humanitarian level, both for the Ukrainians and the Russians. So let me talk a little bit about Russia for a moment. As I understand it, Putin's strategy, and therefore the strategy of his military leadership, initially, when we go back to 2001 and early 2002, the military strategy was one of advancing, fire and maneuver. Picture Desert Storm. Picture World War II. Armored equipment, tanks, armored personnel carriers, etc., maneuvering in the open areas and the battlefield and taking territory. Okay, that taking of territory, the advancement, would be traditional warfare. So that was the initial approach by the military, the Russian military, was to take territory, to advance into with conventional warfare. In early 2022, Putin replaced many of his generals. And what he replaced those generals with were generals that understood that there needed to be a different strategy applied, a different way of thinking that needed to be applied. Because Putin, and this has been open on his part, he has said this over and over in news conferences, in interviews, he does not want to occupy Ukraine, never has, does not want to expend Russian lives for territory, does not want the economic impact of that kind of warfare, nor the cost of what it would take to occupy Ukraine, and then the cost of rebuilding Ukraine by the Russian economy. He had no intention of that. I won't go into the deep dive on this. I want to keep this at a big picture perspective, but the initial approach was, okay, let's take territory. The Ukrainians, very tenacious, very strong war fighters, perhaps not as sophisticated as the Russians in terms of training, tactics, equipment, but nonetheless, they were a tough enemy. And Putin and his generals very quickly realized this is not the kind of warfare we want to engage in, which is losing a lot of Russian military for the sake of gaining territory. So what have they done? They switched the generals out and put the generals in that understand a war of attrition, a defensive posture, to set up along the Russian-Ukrainian border heavy defensive emplacements by the Russian military, such that it would protect the troops. And any advancement that was pursued was on a 1 to 5 kilometer basis. You see, they were operating beneath an umbrella. Satellite imagery, satellite surveillance, drone surveillance, aircraft, loitering aircraft surveillance, the ability to detect the enemy coming against the Russian forces beneath an umbrella of surveillance. And the strategy has been and continues to be not to advance beyond that umbrella, not to move beyond that visual, if you will, system of surveillance. So they've only been moving the umbrella of surveillance 1 to 5 kilometers at a time. The war of attrition is looked at this way. From a position of defensive strength, defensive posture, you let the enemy, in this case the Ukrainian military, advance on your heavily fortified defensive positions. As they advance, the weapons systems are deployed from behind the defenses out into the battlefield and kill the enemy, kill the soldiers. This is why, as I mentioned earlier, Ukraine has been losing over 2,000 military personnel every single day. It is a war of attrition. It is not a war of taking territory. The Western media paints it as conventional warfare on the part of claiming that Putin wants to advance and take territory, such that they put out in the mainstream that Russia wants to occupy Ukraine and therefore presents themselves as an existential threat to Europe, to the NATO countries. Russia on the doorstep of Germany and so forth, France, United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Finland, Sweden, Norway. Okay? I mean, Finland's already bordering Russia, but you get the picture. And it's a false picture, it's a false narrative. Putin has decided on a war of attrition and let the West expend itself against his defenses. And he conserves Russian lives by doing this. So this is what I wanted to share with you that is counter to the Western media narrative and the U.S. political leadership putting out in the NATO meeting last week that NATO needs to strengthen, needs to gear up, needs to get on a war footing because of the territory gaining aggressiveness on the part of Russia. And it's completely the opposite. Hopefully there will be a ceasefire coming soon. I said that Putin has been telling the Assad regime in Syria to hold back until such a time that perhaps there may be a de-escalation in Ukraine and Russia can send more troops and more armament into Syria to build up that defensive posture in Syria in defense of a preemptive strike on the part of Israel against Syria. Okay, just checking my notes here. Oh, by the way, in Ukraine, 70% of the electrical grid has been destroyed by Russia in Ukraine. 70% of the electrical grid. So if you're trying to manufacture weapons and you have very little electricity, how can you mount a defense? How can you run an economy with only 30% of your electricity remaining? And it is summertime, but we inevitably are going into fall and then winter in Ukraine. This will be a humanitarian crisis. This may also motivate Zelensky towards a ceasefire. Winter Remember the Russian winters of World War II? Well, that was in Ukraine as well. Okay. I think we pretty much covered my notes. Ukraine, and this is ridiculous, but Ukraine, it just reported today, Ukraine is blocking the transit, in other words, the transportation, the delivery of oil from Russia to Hungary. The pipelines, the transit lines, run through Ukraine from Russia to Hungary. You'll recall that the Hungarian Prime Minister, or President, I think he's President, Viktor Orban, has been operating as a peace emissary. He's met with Zelensky, he's met with Putin, he met with Xi in China. He has been seeking a negotiated peace in Ukraine. Well, he is the president of the EU, and that presidency, that role is only for 6 months. It's a rotating position. But as president of the EU, Viktor Orban now is being viewed by many of the EU members as stepping out of line in seeking peace with Russia, in meeting with Putin. And he's viewed now as an outcast by the European Union and by NATO. Hungary is a member of NATO. And yet he's seeking peaceful relations with Russia, who is perceived as, declared as, the enemy of NATO. So violating their Article 5, meaning if any NATO member is attacked by an enemy, all of NATO will come to the defense of that member that is being attacked. They view this as a violation of Article 5 on the part of Viktor Orban, such that now Hungary, as a nation, is being punished by Ukraine by denying the transit of Russian oil to Hungary. So you have Ukraine that's seeking NATO membership, and yet it's denying a vital resource to a member of NATO. This is how convoluted this whole thing is. That's why I'm just pacing you through this information. I'm not trying to just run this by, you know, in a rapid fashion, because then it's meaningless. I'm trying to just parse this out to you. That's why I'm really devoting 2 hours for YouTube, for Pulse, which is typically a 30-minute presentation on YouTube. And tonight it's probably going to run 2 hours. We'll see. We may end up a little early. But nonetheless, it's just ridiculous. It's bizarre what member NATOs are doing to one another. Okay. Ukraine again. Again, I'm just going through my notes. Since the war began in Ukraine, the population of Ukraine, I talked about the economic situation, they're nearing default status. They're almost bankrupt. Well, on their population, going into the war, they had about 40 million people in Ukraine, civilians, military, and the like. Due to the war, 40 has been reduced to 22 million. This is genocide. Not so much on the part of Russia, although Russia is obviously killing Ukrainians. But I think when you define genocide, you have to look at the cause. And the cause is the West. The cause is NATO, the United States. Again, NATO and the U.S. agenda is to occupy, take control of the farmland, take control of the natural resources of Ukraine. It has nothing to do with NATO membership. That's just a cover story. That's just an excuse. It's to occupy by NATO, which is supposed to be a defensive organization. It is now an offensive organization to occupy Ukraine. It's pure greed. Therefore, the cause of the genocide is greed. It's the aggression by NATO and the United States. 50% of their population is gone. How does the country recover from that? It takes generations to recover, if they ever do. Ukraine is about to disappear. That's really what it comes down to. Just like Israel is about to disappear as a state. Let's jump over to China for a few moments. The Chinese economy in the mainstream media for several years now, and we've even reported in our live streams that the Chinese economy has been crumbling. Well, the actual figures over the course of the first quarter of 2024, they experienced over 5% growth. Now, they have their problems. There's a lot. There's shadow banking. There's real estate development bankruptcies. There are environmental crises, devastating crops and killing populations. There's a lot going on in China, but economically, they're actually doing better than the United States. We've also reported here over the years that China, like Japan and Germany and other European countries, Switzerland, France, China has been selling off their U.S. bond holdings. They've been holding U.S. debt. They've invested in U.S. debt. Japan has been, on average, has been the largest purchaser of U.S. bonds, followed by China. Both Japan and China have been dumping billions of dollars in bonds, and just over the course of the last week, China has, I think the figure was $30 billion additional $30 billion in bonds that it has sold off. You'll recall and understand that China is part of BRICS. This is an attack on the U.S. dollar. While China has been engaged in what they call diversifying and divesting themselves of U.S. debt and then diversifying into cryptocurrency, into the global cryptocurrency that's about to be announced. While China is dumping bonds, the U.S. has been threatening to shut down Chinese banks in the United States to confiscate Chinese assets here in the United States. This is a declaration of economic war. And this is on the heels of NATO making overtures to Japan for Japan to join NATO. Now, NATO stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. As I said a moment ago, it's a defensive organization that was organized during the time of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. It was in defense of Europe. Well, now it's an offensive organization, and NATO is targeting China. NATO cannot even defend itself against Russia should Russia choose to, which they're not going to, but choose to come against Europe and occupy Europe. It can walk through Ukraine. Europe is in no position to defend itself against Russia. But Russia has no intention of that. If NATO cannot defend itself on its home turf, how can it act as an aggressor against China on China's mainland? We're not talking about defending Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan on those home turfs. NATO's talking about coming against China on its own homeland, its own mainland China. How delusional is that? And it has nothing to do with the North Atlantic. This is pure insanity. Before that even gets to that point, I think the events that are unfolding in the Middle East, and by extension, Ukraine, because they're really connected. They're connected by the U.S. and they're connected by Russia, Ukraine, and the Middle East. The events that are rapidly unfolding in the Middle East will preclude a NATO conflict with China. It's never going to happen. There's not enough time. Now, you'll recall about 3 weeks ago, Putin met with Xi in China, and they now have a mutual defense agreement, China and Russia. There's also a mutual defense agreement that Putin entered into at the same time, same trip, with North Korea. And then he visited Vietnam for business relationships. The U.S. is in no position to come against Russia, China, North Korea, and even Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member, but Turkey already has been making overtures, approaches to leaving NATO and joining with Russia. This is more economic than it is military, but it is an economic relationship on the part of Turkey with Russia, which is what Putin has been establishing with China, North Korea, Vietnam, other Far Eastern countries. Russia certainly has extended itself into South Africa, or the southern portion of Africa, and even to an extent into Libya and into northern Africa, but certainly into Africa, as have the Chinese. But these are business relationships. These are not military. See, the strategy of Russia and China is to occupy economically without a shot fired. But should there be military aggressions against China, Russia will defend China and vice versa. And now North Korea. India is siding with Russia. Business relationships, member of BRICS. Pakistan is now, as I reported, openly threatening Israel by militarily supporting and defending Iran. And certainly Russia is in a military and financial relationship with Iran and Iraq. This is why U.S. troops are being pulled out, they're being thrown out by the Iraqi government. The U.S. is being thrown out because Iraq is siding with Russia. It's economically in their favor to side with Russia. That's how they view it. Now, the Chinese are also involved with Iraq and Iran. So the pendulum is swinging to the east. In my lifetime, the pendulum had swung to the west, and the west was enjoying the economic development and the military superiority as compared to and in a basic adversarial relationship, Superior to the east. That pendulum has now moved dramatically to the east, being superior economically because they're more cohesive, they're partners now, and therefore their military strength surpasses the West. This is why NATO is defensively, but really offensively, they view China as a threat, and as China, they mean the Far East, economically threatening the EU and therefore NATO. And so NATO now is taking an offensive, a preemptive posture to try to push back against China. It all comes down to greed. It always does. Wars are fought over resources. The politics are just the vehicle, the mechanism for the greed to acquire resources, to steal from a neighbor, to occupy. It hasn't changed in all of human history. Okay, I think I've exhausted my notes. I do want to end with our scripture for tonight, and even on YouTube, which is typically a secular presentation, I'd like to wrap up this live stream quoting from the Bible, from Matthew 24, verses 5 through 8. Very briefly. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. Fear not. If you're not already saved, if you don't know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, I think I have delivered reasons enough here tonight for you to turn to Jesus Christ, the only way to the Father, to Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. God bless you all, and good night.